it's just got to be a rhythm. So just keep the right rhythm, okay? And this is very simple, right? We're going to start with the harmonium, start with the drone. All right? This is a very, very simple chant. Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. Now check out the melody. Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. You want to try that with me? Here we go. Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram.
Can I make one suggestion?
Absolutely.
The people over here should move into the center of the room.
That's cool. Yeah, well, unless they want to be against the wall in case you move back. So I can see the lovely faces against the wall.
Because we've got like big gaps.
That'll fill in quickly as the massive crowds descend upon the room. Okay? All right, now let's see. All right, Ron, let's start. Slow down. Okay? Let's try this once more. Again, follow the rhythm here.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram.
Tomorrow morning at 7 a.m.
Do your time next week.
Yeah.
Thursday.
That's a simple chant to Lord Rama. In the pantheon of divinities in India, there are many very popular names: Krishna, Rama, Govinda, and among the great devas, Shiva, Saraswati, Ganesh. And each of these gods and goddesses has his or her own particular repertoire of music and chants in praise of the role they play in our lives. And that's one of the extraordinary multidimensional realities of the world of devotion, of bhakti, is that there are these unseen levels, these mysteries that we started to talk about last week. Multiple realities happening all at once. How's everybody doing? Welcome. It's great to see you all. I see some new faces here this evening.
Thursday.
Yes.
Thursday. Next Thursday.
Okay, announcements. Next Thursday is Janmashtami. Janma Astami, the appearance, Janma, the great celebration of the appearance of Krishna. This is, if you will, the Hindu Christmas and New Year's, and everything kind of rolled into one. And there's feasting and chanting and dancing and festivities galore taking place at the Bhakti Center, 25 First Avenue, starting at 6 p.m.?
6 to midnight.
6 to midnight, next Thursday. So see if you can carve out a little time next week to join in the festivities. There'll be... There's feasting, but I'm not sure what time they're serving the feast.
I think kirtan's at 6, then the dharma, and then I think there's prasadam. Mm-hmm. And then 2 days later, they're doing a lotus festival of Vrindavan for the holiday.
Okay.
Very nice. I have the details I can send to anybody who wants that.
Excellent. Oh, we should have... Did you bring the...
No, I haven't.
I'm going to go sit in my seat.
Okay, thank you. Give it up for Michael and the harmonium player.
The ninth.
Thank you. Hi, welcome. Who are you? And where did you come from?
That's like, you know, in the 20s, you'd go to these little hidden places, you know, and you say, Hare Kirtan Center, and they'd let you in.
We're from D.C.
Ah, welcome. Oh, lovely, lovely. Hare Kirtan is a dear, dear friend. And also the person who did the video that you see when you go to the Jiva Mukti website. He and his partner Elizabeth did that opening video, you know, kind of montage of classes and so on. That's their work. Welcome. What are your names? Are you with them? Oh. Don't you wish you were? What's your name? Huh? Remington, I remember you from your other appearances here.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming back.
Had all the best AT class today, so...
Ah, oh, how'd you do?
I'm doing all right with the SAT class.
Okay, wish you luck again.
Thanks.
Your name is?
I skipped the class. I'm the mom.
Oh, you're the mom! That's
the
right,
you
both...
To your class,
you have to forgive me, I'm sorry. Last week I actually had a fever, so I Things were a bit of a blur, but I'm feeling better today. Welcome back.
Thank you.
It's our mother-son act here at Jiva Mukti. And your name is?
Samantha.
Samantha, hi. And are you a yoga teacher?
I am now, yes.
Yeah, well, congratulations.
I've been listening from Podcastland for a long time, so I'm so excited to be
here. Oh, aren't you nice? Thank you. And same, I've been relishing meeting you from listening to your listening. Thank you very much for coming. Samantha, and your name is?
Lisa.
Lisa, hi.
Hi.
How you doing?
Great.
I met you before?
Never met
you. No, I haven't.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, welcome.
Yes,
indeed.
Yeah, I was saying that. But I did get once before. Unfortunately, you were absent. But I have the one that Rosna
got. Oh, yes, earlier. Wonderful.
Yeah, which is nice.
Very nice. Good, good. I'm glad you got to hear him.
Yeah.
So, Samantha, Lisa, and?
Carolyn.
Carolyn, nice to meet you. Do you all go to the same yoga classes in Washington? Is that, you know each other?
We all just finished the training party.
Uh-huh, very nice.
Yeah. And we studied the Gita with
them. Wonderful. So nice to have you with us. Thank you. Thank you for stopping by on your road trip. Anna, how have you been?
Great.
I haven't seen you in such a long time.
I was Yangji.
Huh?
I was Yangji. Sorry,
I
can't help but notice that's Yangji.
Thank you for being back.
It's lovely to be back.
Yes. Well, the feeling is mutual. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Fine. How was your week?
It's been good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like Katharine Hepburn used to answer when people would ask her, how are you? She'd say, well, I'm fine as long as you don't need to know the details. There's always more to the story, isn't it? It's nice to have you here. What's going on? I see you got a little summered.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I have to live like a respectable citizen.
Yeah. This is Nick. Nick and Anna, all three of you actually, have a yoga studio called Agora Yoga in Queens, in Astoria, Queens. And so if you're ever road trekking through Queens, you can stop at their yoga studio.
Yeah, I have a joke.
You have a joke? Okay, what's your joke?
I'm getting kicked out of this all day. Stop me if you heard this. What did the yogi say to the hot dog vendor?
Make me one with everything. Come on, Nick.
Nick,
I was 3 years old when that joke first came out. Except you have to say, you know, what did the yogi say to the vegan pizza?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But then the yogi gave the hot dog vendor $10, and then he stood there and waited, and then he said, can I have my change? And the hot dog vendor said, change comes from within.
Ah, okay. Oh, now, ba-da-boom.
Wow.
Now we're getting somewhere. There you go.
Weird.
Now we're getting somewhere. All right. Props to Anna for the follow-up. This is Michael over here, our public relations director and head marketing.
Oh, this is the new student. You have two great books by donation. The first one was written by our teacher. It's you want to talk about the book real quick?
It's an introduction to the Bhagavad Gita. Real quick.
And then Here Comes the Sun, which is the autobiography of George Harrison's Gojo. Sir Vito Vich.
When he went to Target, and they said they were sold out.
They sold out.
Oh, and we have Java bags for.
We may have some.
$5 donation. Right?
Yes, as a matter of fact, we should start with a bit of Java. Do you do Java in Herkutan's class? You do. Okay. So, do you have your own beads with you?
Not with me.
But you have beads.
No.
Those are the. Oh, you've already. You go, girl. Okay. Has everyone chanted japa before? If you haven't, let me just walk you quickly through this. Do you want to turn on the Prabhupada japa tape? We have a bit of ambiance when we do our japa here. It's a short japa. We do, not always, but we're kind of getting back into the japa groove. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, yajñānām japa yajñosmi. He says of all the kinds of offerings that one can make, yajna, offering of sacrifices, I am the chanting of the sacred japa, sacred names. Japa is a personal meditation. In fact, this round of beads, this strand of beads, is called a japa mala, or a garland of wooden beads. The wood used in a mala for the chanting of the Krishna mantra comes from the sacred tulsi bush, which is reputed to only grow in devotional environments. So in temples, Krishna temples, and in homes, you'll see these lovely bushes that are sometimes described as in the family of the basil plant. But they're a genus of their own. And when the plant dies, the branches are lathed into these tiny beads. I think I've told you this. How do they make these? How do you lathe a tiny bead? When I went to Vrindavan, I finally saw how they do it. With tiny lathes. They're literally this big. And they're sitting there like, turning out these tiny little beads. It's marvelous to see. You'll notice that on the japa mala, on the strand of beads, there's one that stands out. Sometimes it's decorated with a kind of a tassel. That's called the Krishna bead or the mountain bead sometimes. You don't cross over that. You go up to that and then go back in the other direction. Using the first and third fingers of the right hand, and you can either drape it around your neck if you wish, or hold it in two hands like this, but try not to let it touch the floor. It's sacred. It's only used for chanting sacred mantras, names of the divine. And it's a nice way to just kind of calm down from the day, breathe, and kind of move into a sacred space for our Gita gathering here. So if you can chant along with Prabhupada on the tape or at your own pace, just loud enough for yourself to hear. It's not meant for everyone to hear. So at your own pace, if you like, we'll go for maybe 5 or 7 minutes, and then just allow the sound to have its effect. So you can begin whenever you're ready. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Rama, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Rama, Hare Rama. Michael. Thank you. It's described that there are three impediments to effective mantra meditation. The first is fatigue. Since the practices are often performed early in the morning, if you haven't had a good night's sleep, it's quite possible that you'll be nodding out. So fatigue is one hurdle on the road to pure chanting. There are different stages of chanting. There's offensive chanting, which is chanting with total indifference or for some material purpose. There's a clearing stage of chanting, and then there's pure chanting. Setting aside offensive chanting, which we could discuss at some other time, the clearing stage of chanting has three hurdles to overcome. One is fatigue. The second is distraction. Now, I'll confess to you that sometimes when I'm chanting in the morning, I get distracted. I've got thoughts about things that I want to get done or whatever, because I'm not a very advanced chanter. So in order to clear my head of that, I'll sometimes just keep a little notepad over on the side. I'll just write it down. I don't have to think about it. It's just gone. And then come back to the focus on my chanting. And the third is indifference. That the chanting is, it's what it is. It's a lack of understanding of the power of the chanting or what's actually happening. It's an invocation. It's a prayer. It's inviting God into your life. It's inviting Krishna into the room with you. So usually before chanting, it's customary to wash hands, to find an appropriate place if you have a little sacred area in your apartment or your house, with an altar perhaps. Or just some courtesy, if you will. It's an extending of courtesy, because the name and the person who is represented by that name are not different. So in the name, there is the presence of Krishna. So those are the three things to be attentive to. We're in the fourth chapter of the Gita, and I believe it's verse 21. Michael, am I correct? 21 was last week? Yeah, so 22. Would you kindly repeat the invocation after me, and then we'll recite the verse and then have a discussion. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 Some of the Sanskrit words in this verse have diacritic marks that might be a little confusing. The dot under the R in the first word is a R. The dot makes an R into a R. So, yadrichcha. The two C's are actually pronounced, so it's a ch. Almost like a stutter. Yadrichcha, labha, santushto. Again, the dot under the S makes a S into a sh. So that diacritic mark, that dot, changes the pronunciation. Yadrichcha labha santushto. Here's the melody that can go with this. Yadrichcha labha santushto. You try that line. Yadrichcha labha santushto. Vandvati tova matsara. Vandvato tova matsara. Try that line again. Dvandvatito vimatsara. Dvandvatito vimatsara. Samak siddhav asiddhocha. Samasiddhav asiddhocha. Kritvapi na nibadhyate. Kritvapi na nibadhyate. Yadrichcha labha santushto. Yadrichcha labha santushto. Dvandvatito vimatsara. Dvandvatito vimatsara. Samaksidhavasidhocha. Samaksidhavasidhocha. Kritva pina nibadhyate. Kritva pina nibadhyate. Nick, you want to give it a go?
Yeah.
All right. Yadrichcha labha santushto. Dva, dva, dvandva. Dvandvati.
Dvandvatito.
Dvandvatito vimatsara. Samasiddhavasiddhocha. Krit, krit. Anyone else like to try? Share? Yadrichcha labha santushto. Dvandvatito vimatsara. Samasiddhavasiddhocha. Kritvapi na nibadhyate. Very nice. Nicely done. You chant these mantras, and they have a what sometimes is described as a purificatory effect, a purifying quality to them. They're not ordinary sounds. These ancient mantras have the provenance of a non-material realm. They come down. It's called descending. These verses are descending knowledge. There's two kinds of knowledge. Ascending knowledge, which is arrived at through the agency of our own intellect and sensory input, what we're capable of understanding. And then descending knowledge, knowledge which comes down in a disciplic line from a time prior to cosmic creation. That may require a certain degree of faith. I mean, there's no videotape of the Bhagavad Gita coming in at the dawn of time. But the teachings have withstood generations and generations of millennia of transmission. And this was a topic of discussion earlier for me today, that I read an article recently about the Bible, and how prior to Gutenberg in the 15th century, the Bibles were all hand copied, as were most sacred texts and most early literature, were copied by scribes. You had people in rooms, and they would literally transcribe one copy of a book to another. Well, along the way, when you're transcribing something, mistakes can happen. So if you want to make an academic really laugh hard, just say that what we're studying here today are the exact words that Krishna spoke on the battlefield of Kurukshetra 5,000 years ago. That's a little hard to defend on the record. There is no archaeological evidence that can back that up. So there is a certain degree of faith. What's interesting about the sacred teachings of the Vedas, in particular the Gita, is that everything that can be proven about what they say has been proven accurate. There are parts of the teachings that transcend material calculation. Those parts need to be taken on faith. But everything that can be shown through evidence and trial and error and experimentation from the sacred texts has proven accurate. I'll give you an example. The texts talk about the quality of cow dung as being antiseptic. Now, the same text, the same Sanskrit text, say that if you touch stool, if you touch excrement, you must immediately go and bathe because it carries disease, it's considered unhealthy, unclean. You must immediately go and bathe. And yet these same texts say that cow dung has an antiseptic quality. And in fact, if you analyze the chemical composition of cow dung, it is antiseptic. It's used as a poultice. If you cut your hand in India, they'll just take some cow dung, purified cow dung, and use it as a poultice. The way we would, for example, clay to absorb impurities. It's used as a heating device. Cow patties are dried and used as clean heat. They emit no noxious gases. What they do emit is methane, which is captured in what's called a Gobor gas contraption. So there's this perfect ecology in India where you take the rinds and peels from the kitchen after you've prepared a meal, feed them to the cow. The cow creates dung, which is then used even for insulation in homes. There are homes that are decorated with a designed cow dung on the walls. If you go to the Bhakti Center, the temple room is decorated with purified and designed cow dung. 25 First Avenue, experience of a lifetime. So those parts of the text that can be, if you will, empirically tested, have proven accurate. Did you have something you'd like to say, Jack?
I was just saying, maybe this is like the listening of...
In villages?
The floors.
Yes. The floors also.
Just
sweep up and put a new layer down. So these mantras, these verses, are sacred sound. There may be some degree of faith in that statement. But the proof of the pudding, as they say. If you chant these verses, you will begin to experience different kinds of subtle changes in metabolic level, in thinking, thought processes, in the way you deal with the exigencies of daily life, just from coming in contact with sacred sound. It's a beautiful thing, quite beautiful. So here's the translation of this 22nd verse from the 4th chapter. He who is satisfied with gain, which comes of its own accord, who is free from duality and does not envy, who is steady in both success and failure, is never entangled, although performing actions. This is one of the extraordinarily beautiful statements of the Bhagavad Gita. This is a seminal verse, a key verse. Let me read that to you again. He who is satisfied with gain, which comes of its own accord, who is free from duality and does not envy, who is steady both in success and failure, is never entangled, although performing actions. It's a beautiful sentiment, and when you unpack that, it seems impossible. How can anyone ever reach such a place of such total equanimity when confronted with the kind of challenges that we're confronted with every day. Much of the teachings of the Gita deal with how to manage tragedy, stress, and challenge. A lot of the teachings of the Gita are about that. There's a reason why that's emphasized. If we allow ourselves to become too preoccupied with issues that deserve attention, but if we allow their importance to grow beyond a reasonable point, how do you then focus on that cultivation of inner consciousness? The distractions will be overwhelming. Does this ring any bells for anybody? How many of you have been in a situation where you've just felt so overwhelmed by... I felt that way this past week. I was sick. I had a fever. And I was coughing. I didn't realize the body could create that much phlegm. It was just like crazy. I lost 5 pounds in 6 days. And I felt utterly useless. There was this helplessness. You know, when you're diseased, nothing seems right. And you can't do anything. You don't have the energy. You don't have any enthusiasm. You can't focus. I was literally sleeping. I had to sleep half the day. Now my body just had to get rid of whatever was going on in there. And so when your world shrinks down like that to a point where that's all you can focus on, this is all I got, my reality now, it's become this small. You know, my body's hurting so much. Very, very difficult to reach this kind of equanimity, free from duality, does not envy, steady in both success and failure, to which we might add health and illness. Now this is emblematic of duality, of the different kinds of highs and lows that we can hit. My mom, don't tell her I told you this, okay? But my mom's getting on in years. And not so much her, but a lot of her friends. They're, you know, we talked about this last week. They begin to identify with their ailments. You know, that's what you know. It's like, you know, the world becomes smaller. A lot of her friends have died now. So socially, her social world has shrunk. You know, really important. Keep the mind active, people. This you can always keep going. Expose yourself to ideas. Expose yourself to challenging ideas. I think we can live a long time in a diseased condition. I don't think we can live very long without beauty, without exposing ourselves to intellectually challenging, emotionally stimulating experiences. And if you have that, you can deal with even disease more efficiently because your spirits are high. You know, if you're inspired by that. So if you're feeling, you know, poorly, put some flowers on the table. Make sure that the blinds are up. Get some sunlight coming in. Expose yourself to nature. Give yourself some encouragement like that. Go to a museum if you can do it. You know, read a book about art. You know, listen to music. Beautiful music, not rock. He who is satisfied with gain which comes of its own accord. Now, okay. I had a guest today up at my place, not far from here. Most wonderful person. She's retired from being head of student services in the Brooklyn school system. Very, very well respected family counselor. And she works with what are called constellations. It's a kind of therapy which essentially there's a role-playing quality to it where the early experiences of childhood are brought back to the surface and someone might play the role of a father or mother figure so that if there is someone who has done you harm, done you wrong, there's an opportunity to confront that, acknowledge the role that it's played in your life, And she's a devotee. She's an initiated Krishna devotee. And it's marvelous talking with her because the conversations revolve around this verse. What is it about ourselves that impedes us, that stops us from reaching that point of equanimity which would allow us to make our best decisions?
Attachment.
Huh?
Attachment.
Attachment is one. There are many, many factors. But what's fascinating when talking with Christina, coming out of the kind of training and background that she's had in psychology, she teaches in behavioral psychology at NYU, is that we'll talk about, it was my favorite theme song here, how the Gita and psychology are like parallel tracks. And what the Gita, what Krishna in his own language here, in a language of the Bhagavad Gita is describing, is the different layers of ego, the different layers of selves that we live with. We're many people. We talked about many realities. We're many people at one time. There's the intellectual ego. There's the conscious, rational, analytical mind that we identify with. That's one level of ourselves. Things have to make sense to us. We don't blindly move along with something. So that part of ourselves analyzes, discerns, tries to differentiate between good and bad, acceptable and not acceptable. You know, details, details, and details about those details, and more details about those details. That's Jill Bolte Taylor. If you don't know who she is, ask me later. So there's the intellectual self. There's the emotional self. We react emotionally to things, sometimes completely outside any intellectual, rational reason. You'll hear a song and you'll start crying. It's not an intellectual reaction. Or someone will say something and you'll be terribly offended. Something is going on a subconscious level, not a conscious intellectual level. There's the physical self, the erotic, sensual self, the self of the body. That's also responding to different kinds of stimuli in different ways, and it's highly individual. No two people have the same kinds of... The Bhagavad Gita describes that we are born into this world with a set of senses and sense objects. The attractions and repulsions that we feel are highly unique. You can't come up with a simple biological explanation for why we like the things we like. The same things that thrill one person will utterly disgust someone else. The Sanskrit terms for that are guna and karma. The behavioral influences that govern our reactions to the world around us on a sensory level. Go deeper, 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 deeper. And when you finally get down to the deepest self, the core self, the Atma, that's the object of the Bhagavad Gita, is to focus our attention there. We went to a yoga class, Michael and I, earlier today. And it occurred to me that one of the things that makes yoga so fascinating and so rewarding, well, let me not say it. Let me ask you guys. You take yoga. What makes your classes so satisfying? You come out of a class, how do you feel? What do you feel when you come out of a yoga class? You guys, you're all yoga teachers.
Yeah, I'm really euphoric. I feel like I got a lot of oxygen in me.
Okay, so physically you're feeling good?
Yeah, physically great. Yeah.
Okay, what else do you feel? Anything else? Is it just physical?
Your mind is not fluctuating as much. It's steadier, calmer, slower.
Okay, very nice. Why is it that the mind feels more calm when you come out of a yoga class? Do you have an answer to that question, Rodney? Because hold off your comments for later. I want to focus on this one question right now. Why is it that when we come out of a yoga class, our mind feels so peaceful? What has happened during that 60 or 90 minutes?
Well, I think it was because I was patiently breathing and taking time to trace every breath and live through the course of each breath, and so I feel a bit more patient and more aware of the details.
Right. How did you know what to do during those 60 or 90 minutes that helped your mind to calm down? What's happening in a yoga class?
You're being guided.
You're being guided by whom?
The teacher.
By the teacher. You don't have to do anything.
Yeah, yeah.
You come into a yoga class, responsibilities stayed outside the door. All you got to do is follow the directions. It's an amazing thing, because what's happened there, without anyone saying, just do what I tell you, you know, it's not that kind of a command up front. There's a voluntary, unspoken agreement when you come into a yoga class that you have surrendered your will for that time, to a certain extent, to the direction of the teacher. And very often people will change teachers, leave one yoga class and go to another yoga class, because they're not comfortable mentally with the atmosphere of that class. It's not necessarily that the physical instruction, the asana instruction, is off somehow. But mentally, you know what? I'm not comfortable with this person. I don't feel comfortable surrendering my will to this person for an hour, hour and a half, because I don't feel either safe or I don't feel that this person is understanding me. And so you go to another place where you can be more comfortable surrendering your will. Now, what's interesting about that for me, and I'm new to yoga. I'm old, but I'm new to yoga, the asana yoga, is that I'm discovering for myself some of the points of connection between asana classes and bhakti. And I have this discussion with yoga teachers, and it's fascinating to engage on this level. The asana classes, as they are generally given for most people, are meant to engage physically and mentally, because we're so het up physically and mentally that that's the level that we need to be addressed on. We need that simple, direct connection with letting go. Sometimes it's even that straightforward. Breathe in and say let. Breathe out and say go. Just let go. Let go. Why? Because we're holding on. What is it we're holding on to?
Stress, life, work.
It's I got to do this for myself.
Past,
I have to make the decisions myself. I have to defend myself. I'm the one who's got to pay the rent. I'm the one who's got to get this job done. I got to go take care of this person. It's all about holding on to the impression that if I don't do it, it's not going to get done. So the let go that happens during those 60 or 90 minutes is a letting go of that illusion that if you don't do it, the world is going to collapse. Now, here's what's fascinating. The connection with bhakti is that you can let go and still hold on to the part of yourself that sustains after you leave the room, after the class is over. You take something with you. So unless you've made that connection, the letting go experience ends at the door. And you're back into grabbing on again to those responsibilities. The connection with bhakti, as far as I can tell, is that bhakti places a foundation under your asana practice of self-awareness. So that when you go into that experience of letting go, you do not disappear. You remain intact. You know who you are going into that experience. My own, and I can't recommend this to anyone, but it's for me, because I personalize my relationship with Krishna. For me, the yoga asanas are, this is going to sound kind of hokey, it feels like I'm doing a kind of dance of love to Krishna. That I'm placing myself in what I hope will be quasi-poetic gestures as a way of almost like dancing before Krishna. And that helps me to maintain a sense of self even while someone else is guiding me to do mentally and physically whatever it is I'm doing mentally and physically. So for me, that part gets nurtured. If I'm thinking about Krishna as I'm doing my practice, the practice then becomes a gesture of devotion. It's an offering. It's not just for me. It's an offering. And when it becomes an offering, that I can take with me after I leave the room. That infuses everything I do for the rest of the day. Yeah, Michael.
Well, one of the things that we're taught at this school is Sharon and David, when they do teach their asana classes, that they have a strong foundation in bhakti yoga.
Absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
And when they're speaking on the Woodstock, and they're like, and they say, if you offer up your practice to Krishna or whatever it is, mm-hmm. for yourself, then this is not a devotional yoga. This mm-hmm. is a yoga. Mm-hmm. You're here for a good body, this isn't yoga. You offer it up to a higher purpose, and that is devotional, and that is body. Mm-hmm. And that is yoga. And that's what they teach us up.
Yeah.
That's what Sharon and David.
Yeah. We've discussed how there's this kind of a bit of a concern among yoga teachers that if you get too deep into this kind of devotional side of it, you're going to lose students. So it doesn't often get talked about in the yoga classes that you may have attended, because people want to get started. They want to get into the asanas. That's why they're there. They want to sweat. They want to come out feeling good. They want that high. They want that oxygen high. That's why they're there. Right? Interesting conversation with Zoe earlier today in her class, where her response was that ultimately you don't even need the asana yoga. The only reason it's so popular in America is that we're so physical in this country. We're so into what we're doing, you know, our life as a physical mental reality, that those are the selves that have to be addressed first. But ultimately, you know, I was thinking about this because I'm preparing to write a biography of my teacher, Srila Prabhupada. And as I study his life, there's no evidence that he ever attended a single yoga class. Now, here is someone who's had the greatest devotional impact on the yoga culture of any teacher who's ever come to these shores. And yet there's barely any evidence that he ever practiced any asana yoga. And there are reasons for that. It's not that he was opposed to yoga. I think he was opposed to people who would use yoga as a way of distancing themselves from devotion, which is often what it can be in the Advaitavad school. That, you know, mystic yoga schools, yoga is a way of transcending the body and becoming one with Brahman. So that's a whole other conversation. But here's someone who lived in the bhakti moment, did not require the asanas, because he had reached that conclusion. This is described in the 47th verse of the 6th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. The highest yogi is one who has come to me in devotion, who's learned to awaken the love in the heart.
Then you say that's why the yamas and the niyamas come before asana?
The yamas and niyamas come before asana because you cannot separate your yoga practice from the way you live your life. You can't practice yoga and then be, you know, again stoking those fires that add to the same thing that you're trying to cure. There has to be a yoga lifestyle. There's the yoga class, and then there's the yoga life. And they're not the same thing. They're not the same thing. Yeah.
So
Karen?
Lisa.
Lisa. Sorry, who's Karen?
Karen.
Carolyn. Okay, sorry. Yes, Lisa.
So maybe you can correct this line of thinking. But, you know, the first line in the forecourt here makes reference to the fact that someone in Krishna consciousness doesn't really necessarily need to maintain the body or not as focused on it. And I think maybe this is just a Western perspective, but when I see people who are devotional, and I've seen, I think, a handful of people at least that are, you know, in the Bhakti tradition that are very overweight and look unhealthy to me. And they might be, you know, completely devoted. But to me, there's something to be said about maintaining your physical health if you're supposed to be, you know, making progress in this lifetime.
Point well made. I think we need to back up just a little bit. Sometimes people are overweight because they have a glandular condition. Sometimes people are overweight because they have a metabolic situation which does not allow them to process food. One of my dearest friends and closest god sisters in the world, Yamuna, who passed away a few years ago, was morbidly obese. It had absolutely nothing to do with neglecting her body or overindulging in food. She had a condition which she had from childhood, which did not permit her to metabolize food the way we do. So even a little bit of food, it just stayed on her. So I know that you're not addressing the issue in that way, and taking it from the way I know you are addressing it, which is, should we not be taking care of our bodies? Should we not be giving attention to our health? The answer is absolutely so. Absolutely so. I think when Prabhupada talks about a Krishna conscious person not making much endeavor even to maintain his body, he's talking about an acquisitional frame of mind. I don't think he's referring so much to body weight, which does need attention, but more a mentality of the one percenters, we might say. The mentality of the motivation behind action is accumulation. So when he talked about maintaining the body, there's a cultural nuancing, parsing to that phrase. When Prabhupada used that phrase, he didn't refer specifically to the physical body. He was talking about a mindset, a cultural mindset. This I can tell you from having been with him. He's not speaking about the body per se. He's talking about a disposition which says, my comfort in this world is more important than knowing myself spiritually. Does that help? Well, that said, you know, I could go a step further and say that I agree with you. I kind of wish that from the outset we had had yoga classes when I was a young devotee. I have hamstrings now that are so tight that I'll never be able to do a forward bend. Never. The reason is that from the age of 19, I was sitting like this. I walked into the Krishna temple in London. It was December 26, 1969. And I sat down because I couldn't do it at first. Then after a while, my legs got adjusted and I sat down like this. And that's how they stayed for 13 years. Living in ashrams. No one ever bothered to tell me, hey dummy, do a reverse so that your hamstrings don't atrophy. You know, do some extensions. No one ever said that. So we're sitting there in the temple, hours every day, hours sitting like that. Just like this. And so now I pay the price. You know, which is that I get, we call them cramps, and I get, you know, I can't do forward bends. There's all these problems that I have with my leg. So in that sense, I share perhaps a concern that you have, which is why is there not more of attention paid to the care of the body? Am I getting a little bit closer?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Didn't know me, and I think he was just, you know.
yogi stone feeling. I mean, all the teachers know, you can look around the room and you can see all the students who are trying so hard, and they're still pushing themselves so hard, and they've got to do it, and they've got to sweat, and they've got to get into the arm balances, and they're not releasing anything. I think we're so hard on ourselves. You know, I really read this as a, you know, I, the first thing I...
Hard on yourself, hard on ourselves in what way? Okay, well, welcome to Sunset Gita. I mean, you're touching on one of the points that we often talk about here, which is, how can you love others until you've learned to love yourself? And the question is, what's healthy self-love? What is healthy eros? What is the healthy sensual self, erotic self? And that's... you know, there's no simple answer to that question. It's a culture where we are compromised, I think, by living in an environment that does not support that. It's quite the opposite. There was a documentary. I'm sorry, but I am having a crap in my legs. So that's what I'm doing. There's a documentary on HBO currently called About Face, which is about older women who had been supermodels in their youth. And it's fascinating hearing the comments that they have to offer about whether to have plastic surgery or not to have plastic surgery, and using metaphors like, well, if your ceiling is about to fall down, won't you want to do something to support it? Or, you know, this is, you know, these are your work tools. Don't you want to keep them in shape? You know, and there's, you know, it's fascinating. And yet then there's the other side of it, which is where they talk about how we were so lost. We were so egotistical, so caught up in this super world of being, you know, physically perfect, that you lived in constant fear, because every time you would go in for a shoot, people would be talking about you like you were a piece of meat. Well, look at this photo. Oh, God, those cheekbones. What are we going to do about that? Well, we'll just turn the lighting right. Those teeth. What are we going to do about those teeth? And they're being picked apart as though they were some kind of a, you know, modular machine sometimes. And that's where the culture focuses on that. So there's a balance. There's a proper balance between moving away from that overemphasis on the body, that overemphasis on our material condition, and an indulgence in it. You know, and not an indulgence maybe so much as succumbing to the pressures of living a life that has been defined by others as a successful one. And finding that balance is an art. It's a real art. And it's not the same for everyone. It's not the same for everyone.
that's difficult to accept.
What? That?
To not be judgmental of that. It's not, that it is not the same for everyone.
Well, when we reach a point where we can stop judging, you know, I mentioned this wonderful friend of mine who, if she's not 70, she'll soon be 70. She's not a, you know, svelte woman. You know, her body's not a yogi body. My God, what a spirit this woman is. What a gift she is. So, you know, I'm not quite sure. It's, I guess the bottom line is stay healthy. Whatever you need to do, stay healthy. As long as you can. Okay? And if along the way you also look nice, well, fine. Good for you. Yeah.
I have so many thoughts. It's what, I mean, so many thoughts about, like, about what some of your people were saying, what you were saying, like, she was saying about a person who needs to ask us and ensure that. But I've always been taught this, like, a four-fold path of yoga, calm yoga, bhakti yoga, yang yoga, calm yoga, and truly doing all of them, which keeps us balanced in itself. That's what we need to do. So, and I think that's the best thing as far as that's concerned. But also, I think about some of these yogis, there's just so involved that the body doesn't even matter. That they can be sitting meditating for days, they're sitting there, you're sitting there, feces, it doesn't matter because they're not touching the body. Right? And in that sense, friends, I don't know, is the person in that state, and that's why they're obese and it doesn't matter to them? I can't say, because I don't know the person. And like I was just thinking about what he was saying about yamas and yamas and so forth, and that I was always taught that in meditation, you can tell if your meditation is getting better if your yamas and yamas are getting better. So I don't know if you would agree or not. I was just thinking because so many people are so concerned about the asanas, and I got to switch back, it has to look so perfect. But I would wonder, in that way, does that also apply to asanas? Not to be so focused on how the asana looks, or how flexible I am, but maybe it'll show up in that my yamas and yamas are getting better. And the other point I was thinking about as far as bhakti yoga, as far as I've always learned, bhakti yoga is always about surrender. It's just about the fact that you are just as you just surrender and I'm too stupid to try to figure all this out and so forth. The only thing I can do, like anybody who's done a 12-step program knows, the first thing is surrender to a higher power. And in a sense, we all have our addictions. We all have our attachments. And the first thing to do is just surrender. And a part of that, just be humble and humility. So getting to my question is what do you suggest we can do to better surrender? So, because otherwise, we're just going to suffer, aren't we? And as far as the verse that you were reading, it was all about duality and overcoming that duality so we can be in this perfect state. I've always learned to overcome duality, you have to be in the present. So one is, how can we better surrender? And two, what do you suggest in being more in the present?
That was like that wasn't a question, that was a PhD thesis. And that was amazing. You sort of put a lot into that. Let me see if I can address some of it. I don't think I'm going to be able to answer everything that you.
So that's two questions. You want to?
Well, first of all, I think you're right that Patanjali recommends that we pursue our yoga practice with respect for two principles, ahimsa and satya. Ahimsa means nonviolence. Don't hurt yourself. Don't practice yoga with some kind of, you know, Olympic mentality. That's what you've heard about this person who's trying to make yoga into an Olympic sport?
Yeah.
What are they thinking? the idea of making yoga into a competitive sport.
It's from the Bikram lineage. It's been going on in India for like 500 since the British conquered.
Right.
And
then satya means truthful. You know, practice yoga truthfully, meaning not pretense, not posturing. It may be a posture, but don't posture. Don't vogue. It, be honest about your abilities, where you are in your yoga practice. So, and then so far as surrender is concerned, prapatya is described. Prapatyate is the verse in the Bhagavad Gita. It's not a word that has a particularly favorable connotation in English. I mean, when you hear the word surrender, it usually means defeat. It means you've been defeated in battle. You know, it means you've lost. It means that you've given up. It's not a particularly positive word. We might put a different kind of lens on prapadyate if we think of it in terms of love being something that is all-encompassing. Not surrender in the sense of, I no longer have any free will, someone else is going to make the decisions for me, I don't have any role in this, I'm done. Surrender in the sense of, I can't do anything. So I'm not quite sure I agree with what you were saying in that sense. At least so far as the Gita is concerned, the objective is quite the opposite. The objective is to bring Arjuna, who's in a position of saying, I surrender, in the sense of I give up, to a place of saying, I will never surrender. I have the right, the capability, and the authorization to do what I'm doing and to enter into this combat with full self-confidence that I am where I'm supposed to be, doing what I'm supposed to do, and that I'm capable of doing it. And it's for the right purpose. Now, there's no surrender in that. If anything, there's a take charge attitude of empowerment, to use that kind of overused word. Huh?
Let go and let God.
Let go and let God. Okay. Yeah. Now, I hear what you're saying, and certainly we need to appreciate that in 12-step programs and other programs like 12-step, there is an admission that on my own, I cannot do this. There are other forces at work here, much greater than me. That acceptance that I did not create this universe, I'm not in control of everything. Surrender in that sense, that's a healthy admission of reality. But who is it who's taking the initiative to come again and again and again to those meetings? It's the individual. And that individual deserves the credit for that. So surrender doesn't mean somebody else needs to make the decisions. Surrender means I will act guided by greater intelligence than my own. So I have to take some exception with the idea of surrender as a moving away from active involvement. Let me see if I can put this in a different context, because I have been working on this biography of my teacher, and it's it's thrilling. I have to say this is the most thrilling thing. I feel very honored to be doing this. Prabhupada is someone who grew up in an environment where, you know, he wasn't a scholar in the academic sense of a scholar. He grew up in the Malik caste, was a textile merchant, a merchant family. And maybe the great benefit that he had was really, really cool parents. He had a mom and dad who really knew how to encourage him. I think if you luck out in the mom and dad department, you've really got a leg up in life. He had that. He had parents who knew how to encourage him, how to set him on a path of devotion. And there was never any question of abuse or neglect or abandonment. I mean, he had a beautiful childhood. Really beautiful. And his father, in particular, had this ambition for his son to become a great devotee of Krishna, and someone who would go out and teach others. So he trained him from early life. How to play mridanga drum, and how to do a Rath Yatra festival with the carts, and how to cook, and offer the food to the deity. The very first time I met my spiritual master was in the summer of 1972, I believe. No, the summer of 1971. He had just come from Russia, trip to Moscow. And we had a small house in the suburbs of Paris, which was our temple then. And I was the only one in the house with Prabhupada and Prabhupada's assistant. His assistant was downstairs cooking. The reason is that all of the others, we had no money. So they were kind of getting back from the airport as best they could. But, you know, I got back first. And this was my first meeting with him. First meeting. And I had been initiated already for a whole year. And so I'm in the next room to where Prabhupada is resting. And then I hear, Jogeshwar. In Bengali, pronounced wise like J, so it was Jogeshwar. Yes, came running in. Yes, Srila Prabhupada. And Prabhupada was sitting on a cushion, not much higher than this blanket. And he was sitting like this with his legs crossed, and he had his hand in his bead bag. So he had a head like this. His hand was in his bead bag. And he was chanting on his beads. He was rubbing his head with his finger like this. And his eyes closed. He saw me come in. And he said, first thing my spiritual ever said to me, throughout my entire life, I have never forgotten Krishna. And then he looked at me and said, even when I was a boy, I had my dolls. And he put his finger out about 10 inches off the ground to show me how tall his deities were when he was a child. His parents had given him Radha Krishna deities to worship. And so he was showing me about the size of his childhood deities. Why he chose, you know, I've been thinking about this for however long it is now, 40, 50 years. Why he chose that to be the first thing he would say to me. I think he was trying to dispel any doubts I might have had about him, first of all. And I took it as a great, an intimate gesture of sharing something personal. Instead of talking philosophy or administrative, whatever, he shared something about himself and his life. And that's how he was, always, very, very personal. And I thought, as I'm doing this research, I look back on the trajectory of his life. And I see someone who managed to be so free. He was so free. He was so, verse 22 of chapter 4. He was not acting from these other levels of self, a place of need, a place of material interest, a drive to accomplish something for himself. He was free, not only free to do what he was doing at such an advanced age. He hit 70 when he was on the boat coming over here. 70. But free to move away from the tradition, initiate women, oversee partnerships of his disciples, inaugurate programs that so broke every rule of the book. Like, amazing. He was free of all constraints because he wasn't driven by any of those things that hamper us. It was amazing, really amazing.
So, my question, reading from the third part, when it says he labors honestly as far as in his power and is satisfied with whatever is obtained by his own honest labor. So in situations where, you know, an employer wants to ask his or her boss for a raise, or like an artist is commissioning something and is negotiating with a patron, what if that boss or patron just says that, you know, if you were really Krishna conscious, you'd be happy with what you had.
All right, this is the biggest mistake that has ever been made in the history of spiritual practices. The single biggest mistake is to think that surrender or detachment, you know, is synonymous with indifference, lack of initiative, inattention, inaction, irresponsibility. This is so much damage has been done in the name of surrender, in the name of be detached, you know, be equipoised. It's bizarre how we could have had such a wildly wrong idea about what detachment means. Detachment means that you throw yourself into what you're doing with even greater enthusiasm and greater energy because it's not for selfish, egotistical purposes. You're doing it for a higher purpose. Is that not reason enough to go beyond what you think yourself capable of doing? Surrender doesn't mean doing less. It means doing more. I dare any of you in this room, any one of you in this room, to show me one shred of evidence that you've maxed out, that you've reached your capacity, that you've done all you can do. This is it. I can't do any more. This is who I am. This is what I'm going to do. This is my level in life. In fact, I would challenge you to defend a counterstatement, which is you've just begun. You want to talk about surrender? Surrender is the first step. And now you can move forward and really make an impact on the world because you're not acting for selfish purpose.
How could that employee or artist respond if the accusation being thrust at them is you're not really Krishna conscious because now you're asking for a raise? How could they retort?
Are you?
I don't know. I can't role play how they would retort, but I would say it can help to think of it that we're all playing some role. You know, this body and the mind that we have are not our true nature, but it's the role that we have in this lifetime.
Yeah.
So if you are a teacher or an artist or you're an employee in some way, you're playing a role. And that role, there are certain standards that go along with that. And part of that is there's a certain compensation for that role. It's not about you, yourself. It's about what does someone who's playing the role of a teacher earn. It's not about who you are. It's about what... It's beyond that. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
And just, if I may, yes, someone wanted to say something? Building on this, if I may, just gently, if you had that sense of yourself as being unfazed by whatever this person thinks he or she might do to you. If you recognize the inviolability of the core self, right? Does that not give you a greater degree of freedom to see this person with compassion, to understand what their concerns are, what their fears are, that they're reacting so unreasonably to a reasonable request? And does that now then not free you up to come back from a different perspective and perhaps address them in a way that would alter the dynamic of the relationship? Now, I'm not saying that everybody is, you know, going to be, you know, going to see the light. I worked for a guy once. If I never see him again, it'll be too soon. He was just downright nasty. But I would say that during the time that we were together, he had respect for me because I understood him. See, his problem was that he too much identified his own self-worth with his work product. When the company was doing well, he was the nicest guy on the planet. When the company was in the pits, so was he. And he was the nastiest snake you'd ever come across. Because he was frightened, literally frightened, of seeing his company go under. So when someone's afraid, Arjuna was in a similar situation. Krishna handled him quite nicely. There's a way to deal with that. Now, that's a whole other course. We can talk about effective communications and you know, upward management and all kinds of skills like that. That's a different kind of session. But the point is that there are ways to respond to that starting from a deeper place. If you try to confront that energy head on, you're not going to win. Michael?
This text, the way it speaks to me in this sense of devotional aspect is one is in Krishna consciousness. One who has an active Krishna consciousness in what they do. Their rewards and their failures they're not affected by them as much as somebody who's not in Krishna consciousness. Because they're able to recognize that they're doing their best that they can. And whatever they're doing their best from a devotional standpoint, of where they're coming from in their natural dharma at this stage. And when they have that consciousness of saying, this is where I'm at right now, and this is the best I can do, and this is how devotional, and this is how successful I am, I do the best I can and work as hard as I can. Mm-hmm. And I'm not far past what this text is saying.
What in Jacques say you could do more?
What?
You could do better?
It's not about if you can do better.
I'm sorry, I'm missing the question.
Wouldn't you say that it's not just doing the best that you can do?
There's always an opportunity to do more. But in some instances, bear in mind that quitting is an option. Sometimes doing more means walking away when a realistic evaluation of the situation says, I've made the contribution I can make here. Now it's up to somebody else. And I have to move forward in a different way. That is also an option.
You might not be able to
stand. You know, becoming a martyr is not spiritual. That's just plain stupid.
That when I talk about surrender, the word surrender, that maybe it has a negative ring to it, and so it's really, you know, unfortunate. Because when I think of surrendering, it's like giving up, you could say. Giving is a very good thing. By giving something, you gain, you reward it, you grow. And by surrendering, I think it's such a great thing. You can surrender, if you want to work on something, to surrender, you can surrender all your false ideas, all your disillusions that you walk around. And if you do that, you work on that a little bit every day, then you get more open. You open up. You open up your heart, or you become open in your mind. And then you're great.
That's a nice definition of surrender. Surrendering the false ego.
It can be, I think.
Nice.
Like that.
I apologize, but we've come to the end of our time here. This is a fascinating discussion. I wish we could continue with it. Maybe we will next week. Yes?
We do accept donations. I like to plug this every once in a while because it helps.
You're so good at this.
Well, it helps pay for the things that we have for our various workshops. So this is a donation-based class, so everybody, as we're breaking down, remembers to contribute. We do appreciate it. Our goal.
Kim, do you have a sign-up sheet?
I did, but we all signed up.
Oh, they did. Okay. We're starting a newsletter, and those of you who would like to, we're going to send out some Gita, a taste of Gita wisdom.
And then help clean up a dance class, because it's been like two people, sometimes breaking it down, and we can get out of here later than normal.
Thank you. The convention here at Jiva Mukti is to close with a recitation of Om. So if you would join me in that. And then what are our vegan treats tonight? Chocolate chip banana bread and strawberries. Yes, talk about denying the body. We deny the body in the very best possible way. Your company. May the week ahead be filled with ever unfolding awareness of the deeper and deeper selves that make up the beautiful person whom you are. And I hope to see you all again, maybe on your trek back. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Have some vegan, yes. Say it again, banana. Chocolate chip banana bread. Thank you. Well, I'm going to take it.
This is great.
Thank you.